The podcast for heroes in the world of Overwatch. This is The Payload.
Everybody, welcome to episode number 15 of The Payload. We are an Overwatch podcast brought to you by BlizzPro.com. I am John Horstman, and with me from Saskatoon, Canada, Mr. Kevin Hovdestad. Welcome to the show, Kev.
It's good to be back, John. I'm looking forward to this week. There's obviously a ton going on. Overwatch is blowing up right now, and I am just so stoked to get into it. Unfortunately, because life gets in the way sometimes, I only get to talk to you this week, and that's kind of sad.
Why? Why don't you want to talk to me?
Well, I want to talk to you, but I want to talk to Jimmy, too.
I mean, I want to talk to Jimmy just as much as the next guy, but be like, oh, it's really unfortunate. I just get to talk to you. Come on. It could be a little nicer.
I'm expressing sadness. I miss Jimmy. I miss Jimmy. Jimmy's not here, and I miss Jimmy.
You could have veiled that a little bit more, though.
I'll do better next time.
All right.
Do you want to like start over? Take two?
Yeah. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another... No, we're not doing that.
Nope. We're doing it live. All right. Good.
Kevin, obviously, we have a lot of stuff to go through this week. We just hung out with our listeners 3 days ago, so they didn't get enough of the show. But that show was like an hour and 20 minutes long, so we're going to keep this one a little bit more condensed and really just bring you the stuff you need to know this week, because we did have a lot of things come out of the woodwork, it seems. A lot of changes and a surprise patch with some really cool things. So, as we go and talk about our week, let's talk about the news.
This week in Overwatch.
So, this week in Overwatch, we had a huge, huge patch hit. Kev, how big was it?
It might not be the biggest one yet in total, but it's right up there, man. This is a big patch.
It is a big patch.
This patch came in like a wrecking ball.
Came in, and we, of course, the day after we post the show is when it comes. So thankfully.
Yeah, we're just finished. Like, we're going to talk about all these balance changes, and then Blizzard's like, you know what? They're going to talk about balance changes. We should just change them all again.
Yep.
That's exactly what needs to happen here.
And the balance changes that we talked about ended up being like 9 days old as well. So,
and a bunch of them got like modified or reverted. Like
they did.
Oh, they knew.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this patch then, Kev. So I don't know the number of the patch, but we did see kind of three different things. We saw new content added, we saw balance changes, and we saw map and like content and UI changes. So let's go ahead, run down the list of some of these things that we saw. First and foremost, Kevin, all of the kills, all of the games that you've played, all of the time you've spent with your heroes, gone. Completely gone. It's like ground zero.
Okay with that. I know, like, okay, so for those of you who maybe aren't up to speed on what happened, Blizzard did a career profile reset. So your unlocks and stuff in the game are all still valid. You've still got your skins, your sprays, everything else is fine. But they reset your career profile because they're testing some new stuff. And I can't even begin to pretend that I'm upset, because we've known from day zero in this beta that this stuff was all getting wiped. Before the game goes live, it's all going away. So the fact that they reset it partway through, I'm not upset about. Have you noticed anything different, John? Like, did they change anything, or is it just a reset? Like, from our perspective as players, is there anything visibly different? I don't think there is.
I don't think so. I know they were talking about changing how the career profile was grouped, but I thought they did that in a previous patch. Did they not?
That sounds right. Yeah, I think this was literally from a player facing perspective. I believe this was just a literal push the button and set all the counters to zero test.
Yeah, I think
there's probably more than that to it behind the scenes, but But as far as how it affects your game client experience, it's just those numbers got reset.
Yeah. So, yeah, this did not and will not affect matchmaking, player levels, progression, or rewards. So it really didn't affect you anything except like you can't see your most kills, your time played. What else is in the career profile? Anything else really interesting?
Not of note. I do think it's worth noting that they didn't do anything to your hidden matchmaking rating, because that's obviously a variable that likely is not will be reset along with everything else when they clean the slate going from beta to live. So I do think it's noteworthy that they wanted to leave that particular item intact just to keep the sense of balance as far as your player experience as close and comparable as it has been, because obviously we're now on what, 4 major waves of beta invites that have occurred in recent memory, and a lot of new people, like a lot of new people are entering the ecosystem. So I think it's definitely a good thing that they're not resetting and starting from scratch right now, because let's be very clear here. Like those first couple days right after release, as everybody sort of like either scales up or scales down within the matchmaking system, like it's going to be a little ugly those first couple of days.
Yeah, I've already noticed like a lot of new people. I think it was Jimmy and I, we were playing a few days ago, and on our team, like I'm 22, Jimmy's like 16 or 17. And we had 4.
It's weird. He seems older.
Right. Well, his mom had to sign off on us being able to do the show. So,
of course, yeah,
I guess that makes a little bit more sense. But the 4 other people on our don't give me that nod. The 4 other people on our team were all single rank, and I joke you not, everybody else on the other team rank 45 and higher. It felt awful. We did not get out of the building. I don't really want to talk about it.
Too late now. Although it's interesting, right? Like I feel like this is the same sort of learning experience problem that Blizzard has had with matchmaking in their other team-based games like Heroes of the Storm, where they really want to emphasize skill level, but experience is actually a huge factor. Like somebody who's played 2,000 games, even if they're not good at the game, they've played 2,000 games. They know the maps. They know the toolkits of the characters. Even if they play poorly, they play with knowledge poorly. And people who are playing with no knowledge and well tend not to do well against people who have all of that information. If you're experienced at that level, there's something to be said for not pitting somebody who's brand new against somebody who's seen it inside and out. Even if hypothetically in a perfect world, they are roughly the same skill level. Like it's just that feels really awkward when you play those games where you're like, yeah, I've been playing this game for, you know, 2000 hours and this person has played the game for an hour. Why are we in the same lobby? That's something that I think matchmaking systems in general, the modern game player doesn't want to see that. I as a player am frustrated when that happens right to me.
And I really feel punished for not bringing a full group. And because I feel like every time I'm not bringing a full group, or if I bring, like, we'll play with a few other guys quite a bit, and it always, almost always happens, the people who are high level tend to group together, tend to play in groups, play with friends. There's not a lot of solo queue warriors who are, you know, rank 50, rank 75, rank 100. And I think that's something, you know, that ties into it too, where I think we're getting into a lot more groups. I don't know what the Overwatch team's matchmaking system looks like as far as pairing groups with groups. I'm assuming the system tries to do that, but it just really hasn't been my experience at all.
We could spend all day on this, so we'll drop it. We'll keep going. But like matchmaking in general is definitely something that I feel like Blizzard has done a very good job of in broad strokes, because it's a hugely complicated thing to do well. But it's definitely the area where on a day-to-day basis, your like average game experience is probably more affected by that than balance or level design or just about anything else. Like if there's little glitches in the level, you may or may not run into them. If there's little balance inconsistencies where Lucio's got 5 too many hit points, you probably aren't seeing that on a day-to-day basis. But if you're getting lumped in with a guy who really doesn't belong in the lobby that you're in for whatever reason, skill level, experience, or otherwise, you feel that. You feel that every time you log in and play.
And one person makes such a huge difference in this game. If you have one person who's absolutely awful or one person who's absolutely godlike, I mean, there's a reason why those on fire portraits are there, and that's to kill that person because they're holding their team down, right? And so you've got to kill them, you've got to get rid of them, and I'm finding that a lot. But you're right. We should move on to happier things, and I've got happy news for you, Kev. I think you'll like this one. We've got a new map.
Lay it on me.
We've got a new map.
Oh!
So
I didn't know.
Yeah, you had no idea, huh?
Had no idea.
All right. So new
tell me all about it.
New map, Ilios. I'm going to read this straight from the patch notes here because they paint a beautiful word picture for you. So situated atop a small island rising from the Aegean Sea, Ilios is a postcard perfect Mediterranean town with a bustling harborside, winding paths of rambling hillside strolls, and gorgeous vistas. It is the ideal vacation stop for people looking for a place to relax or for those interested in exploring the ruins scattered at the top of the island, where many artifacts and relics of the ancient world have been recently unearthed. That was one of my best dramatic readings I think I've ever done on this show. I'm just going to say that first and foremost. Kev, I have not got to touch...
kind of a low bar.
Thanks a lot. God, just give me a little bit. So I have not got to play on Ilios yet. I ran through it a little bit by myself in a like a bot game just to kind of see what was going on. But besides that, I haven't got to play on it. Have you got to play on the map yet?
I haven't rolled into it since it got released. I mean, obviously a lot of it's just a numbers game problem, right? If there's now what 9 maps in the game,
yep,
like
9.
Odds are, you're not always going to land on the newest map. You could play 20 games and not hit it. And I think that's been my experience is I really haven't had a chance to play on it. Other than like you say, I kind of loaded it up once to play through it and just kind of look around. Conceptually though, like, I don't know. Okay. Blizzard's level design for this game doesn't have, to me, the same feel as a lot of FPS games in general. Like, I come from a background in FPS of, like, old school Unreal Tournament and Quake and stuff where levels had to have, like, very specific symmetry. You needed to make sure that there was nowhere where anyone could sit still. The level design was more about the function than form, right? Whereas Blizzard's level design is very much about the aesthetic. And this level, even just listening to you describe it, right? Like situated over the Aegean Sea, blah, blah, blah. Like it's pretty. It's super pretty. And ignoring obviously some of the like minor balance complaints, because Lord knows anybody who's been on Reddit has seen the like, oh, how come there's that one really obvious like sniping vantage point? Like the level is super cool. And I think like hats off, credit where credit's due. Their level design team is knocking it out of the park on really making these places feel authentic, believable, legitimate. Like if you could travel forward in time 30 years, you could go visit this place in Turkey or Greece or somewhere in that neck of the woods.
Right. Yeah, it's the aesthetically, like the screenshots, when you pull it up and look it out, look absolutely amazing. There's this one shot where it shows like the whole like harbor and then the trail up into, you know, kind of the island piece. And it's really weird because it's got like a combination of like Minas Tirith meets like a Dutch town meets. It's like this really, really cool, aesthetically pleasing location that is really diverse. And something we actually had a question, an email question, where there was like, what do you guys want to see next for like maps or things like that? And I was like, something Dutch would be cool. And
John's
sure
answer
enough,
was Dutch space age elves. And sure enough,
right?
Was it delivered?
Yeah, so you just got this giant, you know, it's all white and blue with a yellow windmill, like totally, I think that's Dutch, right? It's all those colors. Anyways, I don't know. we're going to get angry emails. We've been asking for emails. Now we're just going to get angry
emails.
Now
we're going to get hate
mail. Pictures of the flag. Great. Sorry, guys. I apologize. But overall, I think this is, maybe it's just because we haven't seen a new map in a while, but I think this is maybe aesthetically one of my favorites that I've seen. What do you think?
I like it. I mean, I think there's definitely, we talked a lot early on in this show, actually, back like months ago before the beta even came back up, about some of the like different places we'd like to see over time. And I know there's still characters and locations that haven't been explored in terms of maps yet that I'm still really excited for. I'm super excited to see, for example, a Parisian Widowmaker-esque level. And I think there's thematically a lot of stuff that hasn't been explored, but of the sort of places in the world and thematic feels that we haven't touched on yet, this one hit a lot of boxes, right? Like, it checked a lot of things off for me, and I really enjoy the look and the feel, right? Like I said, I'm trying very hard to distance myself from my expectations of like symmetry and balance and just look at it and appreciate it for what it is. And from a design perspective, I know they're obviously evaluating the basics of, is it fair for offense versus defense and stuff, but like the core design feel across like the whole game just has, it feels like it's a very tied together package. And every time they add a new map, I never feel like, oh, this is like a tacked on afterthought DLC, like they're just slapping a new map in. Like, they all feel like this has been part of this game since it was first conceived of.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. Moving on a little bit. So we've got some health pack placement adjustments. So health, when you go around the corner and search for that health pack that used to be where you thought it was, it may not be there anymore, so beware of that. You're going to... I haven't run into it yet, but I have a feeling there's going to be a time where I'm like, there used to be a health pack here, and it's not there, and I'm going to die. So thanks a lot, Blizzard. It's like it's a beta or something, just making these changes.
Something like that.
We also saw an adjustment to the payload sizes, so larger characters like Reinhardt can get around them in narrow areas. Like the little tunnel area in, what is the one where it's at night? Dang it. Whatever. I'll never remember it. Anyways, those narrow pathways, easier to get around and get through. So the payload's a little bit smaller. And on a little larger note, we did see a pretty hefty and much welcome change to Temple of Anubis. And in that, we saw a new route. So normally when you're going to the second capture point, you've got the center doorway, which was enlarged, or you sneak over to the right and there's a wall on the left and it's kind of halfway up. So if you can climb or fly, you can kind of get over that wall. But for the most part, not a lot of people get over that wall. And they took that out. So now there are three different ways that you can go in. And this is, in my opinion, a much needed change. The choke points were too tight. You sit back with a Torbjorn or in a Bastion and you just kind of pepper at the main door and have the rest of your team watch the left side. And that's basically all that you need to do to hold down that second point. And any halfway competent team is going to be able to hold that down fairly easily. Whereas this complicates it quite a bit, because when you can squeeze around that left-hand side, if no one sees you, when you come out that door, you are on the control point, right? And so this is going to complicate things. It's definitely going to help the attacking team significantly, but we've got to see if they're going to keep the change. I'm hearing some people say that it's too much. So I don't know. What do you think, Kev?
I mean, I think I like it. Early on in the beta, before everything was sort of rebalanced and all the updates that we've seen over the last couple of patches were implemented, right? I played a lot of Temple of Anubis. It was arguably my favorite map. It wasn't the map I got to play the most, but I would say it was my favorite map, especially on defense, because defending at that second capture point was so... I don't want to say easy because that's not the right word, but it was pretty simple, right? Like I would often look at my team and say, okay, we've got somebody on a Bastion who's going to watch the door. We've got somebody on a Reinhardt who's going to protect everybody because there's only one real obvious line of sight to the actual capture point. I'm going to grab a Widowmaker, get up on one of the pieces of scaffolding or one of those little ledges on the pillar that kind of overlooks the obvious paths in. And if I cover one of them, that means there's only one way in that isn't being watched. And all of the characters who can climb, fly, jump, whatever, to get up to that ledge or up over that piece on the right hand side, you can snipe them. Like they're almost all, because this is, I'm thinking back to before Widowmaker's damage nerf even, right? Like basically if they came up over that ledge, you just pop them off and they were done. It always felt to me like that map had a bit of a, like it had such a huge limitation because it wasn't like Hanamura, right? Where when you're going in on that second point, there's a couple three ways in. And as soon as you're through the door physically, you can kind of divert and go around the corner and there's other line of sight blockers and generally some other vectors. And even Hanamura, obviously, there's the outside ledge where if you can vaunt over that gap, you can come at it from the side coming into capture point B. Like there's obviously other ways in. Most maps have something like that. I want to say Temple of Anubis was the only one where I ever felt like as the offensive team, you were basically being massively punished for not having a coordinated attack strategy. And we talked about this a lot last week, right? If you aren't heavily coordinated on offense, you're going to lose 60% or more of your games because you can't actually break through that line. And Temple of Anubis was the far and away worst outlier in that regard.
Yeah. And even getting to the first, the first capture point is already a huge chokehold, right? Because you've just got the one kind of three arc bridge. No, sorry, two. And then there are doorways there where you can divert. But when you're setting up defense, even then, that's a fairly easy, again, with a coordinated team, that's a fairly easy place to hold. And so it was just really hard to attack on that map. And this definitely helps the attacking team for sure. So moving down the list here, we also saw some big changes to playing versus AI. We've got Zarya and Roadhog now, who are not included in the AI games, which is nice. We've also got different difficulties that a player can choose when you're setting up custom games. And you now have a kill cam in your custom games, which is kind of nice as well. And then across the board, we just saw some custom game improvements as well as AI improvements. And then we added a bunch of new sprays. So a bunch of new sprays, nothing really super surprising there. Anything else we need to hit for content added, Kev? Anything else you wanted to touch on?
Not really. I mean, I think it's worth noting that AI mode has kill cam functionality now because that wasn't the case previously. And even if you've got the AI dialed down to next to nothing, the easy AI is still occasionally going to probably pick you off if you're not experienced with the game. And for people who are learning, I think having that option is a really nice touch.
Yeah, I agree.
Overwatch basically from the outset, design wise, has always felt like it's a game that's not massively approachable if you don't already know the genre, in terms of the new player experience, right? The user interface and stuff. Trying to set up custom lobbies, play with your friends, get to know the maps, play games, like nothing about it was really, you weren't being walked through it, right? When the first beta build came out, there was no real good tutorial. There was nothing really in the way of like practice modes. The game just really felt like you need to already know what you're doing before you can climb on board. Like the you must be this tall to ride bar was just set really, really high as far as I'm concerned for a game that they're hoping to open up to a whole new audience of non-Blizzard fans, especially on console. So seeing these things added now, especially kill cam versus AI, I think tells me that they're really serious about tidying up some of those minor omissions from earlier builds before the game goes live.
Yeah, totally. I wish I had something to add to that, Kev. you ever get that moment where you're just like, oh,
yeah, you're like, happened. I agree. No, I just agree. Let's
I
move
do
on.
Podcasts and I can't.
I speak. Also a word.
I also too have these things. So balance changes. We did see some minor, or I would say we didn't see a lot of balance changes, but they are fairly big in their impact on the game. First, Junkrat's Rip Tire finally costs a little bit more. So it costs 25% more. The development team states that they felt that, especially with the new changes to more health for the Rip Tire, it was happening too often. And so they went ahead and decided to make it a little bit more expensive, not happen as often during the game and not happen as quickly at the start of the game, which I completely agree with. That was really, no, you don't agree?
I mean, maybe, right? Like the problem with this is it's another one of those changes that in the short term feels really good because it solves some of the skill gap problems. But in high level games, like if you go and you watch like competitive level Overwatch streamers, nobody's killing anybody with Rip Tires to begin with, because as soon as you hear that sound effect, everybody turns and burns it and it never actually gets to connect because it dies, right? This was a huge problem before the health buff. It's still a problem now. Like, it still dies, and it's actually in some ways worse now, because if you turn and shoot it, if you can kill it before it gets set off, it doesn't actually explode, right? Like, I think this is going to make Junkrat the kind of character who sees very little high-level play, because he's going to be so successful at, like, mid-level play, and that's what this change is for. It's to solve for the people who are, like, getting the big 3-4 multi-kill, like, blow everybody off of a defensive capture point, play the game level maneuvers, right? Like, it's a super powerful ult. It's made more powerful by the health buff, but it's probably going to... And larger radius, you're right. But it's probably going to eliminate him as a competitive tier player in a lot of ways, other than in terms of strict counterplay.
Right. I mean, I think it used to be you could sit around a corner and just bring that Rip Tire straight at them. I think you have to be a little bit more intentional of not like driving your Rip Tire down a street, you know, like right down the middle. Make sure you signal before you turn right, kind of thing. Instead, you're going to actually have to, you know, wait for a team. It's maybe right around a corner, so they don't have the time to react as much as they do. Maps like Gibraltar, Watchpoint Gibraltar, at the very end of the payload, that's a great place. It used to be a great place for Junkrat's Rip Tire because everyone was always swarming at the very end and you could get great multi-kills. Whereas now, it's wide open. You have to drive it right down the highway, basically, and the team has an opportunity to react. And I think that's okay. In the past, almost no matter what, Junkrat got significant value from his ult and really couldn't be countered in any way except for hope it blows up far enough away from you, or hope you can hide before, you know, the 10-second timer goes out. Whereas every other ult in the game, offensive ult, you know, can to some extent be countered, hidden from things like that. Whereas Junkrat's, it can, but you have to do that for 10 seconds. So even if he kills nobody, you're hiding from it and running away from it for 10 seconds, which is a huge impact on the game and made it, in my opinion, too powerful. Where now it's like, no, I'm going to be offensive with this. I'm going to find it. We're going to blow it up before it blows us up.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess you're right, right? Like, I think the design intent to me always felt like Riptire was intended to be used in a way that abused verticality, like dropped onto players more than driven into them. And I think this change is reflective of the fact that that's not how he's being played. And that's not honestly something that the levels really lend themselves to, right? The design of the maps hasn't actually borne out how that would have played otherwise. So yeah, you're probably right. It's giving people a chance to react to one of the longest distance, most mobile. And I think, truthfully, the only ult in the game that can be steered, for lack of a better word, in that way. So yeah there's probably you're introducing more counterplay options because it's an ult that has so much flexibility, and that's fair.
Right. Next on the list, Lucio's health has been reverted from 150 to 200, but they're going to address him in a different way. They've reduced his damage by 20%. And his sound barrier costs 25% more. Kev, how do you feel about these changes?
I hate them.
Really?
I hate them. So we just, like, 3 days ago on the last episode of the show, we just finished talking about health reductions on Lucio and Genji, right? Like, we just had this conversation. My opinion then, and I stand by this entirely, was it was a great idea to lower their health and not otherwise change the kit because it introduced counterplay. It allowed you to try and snipe them or pick them off, and you could do a lot more because it's a lot easier to quickly chew through 150 health than 200, and Lucio is obviously a character whose health is being actively regenerated all the time. So the lower his health pool, the easier it is to basically one round him, right? Blow him up during the you know, opportunity to get a combo of some kind off or snipe him. I thought that was a really smart change. I thought it made it so that Lucio players couldn't be as aggressive, because that was really the problem, was Lucio wasn't being played as like a, you know, middle of the pack character. People were using him to frontline. They were using him to knock people away. He was getting up and taking tanks on head to head because he had so many outs and so much health regeneration. And a lower health pool meant that those maneuvers became a lot riskier. Now he has all of the same utility that he had before, but his damage is lower, which makes him a weaker character. And that's not going to punish him in an organized scenario. Okay, a lower damage point on Lucio isn't a big deal in a 6-on-6 fight. It's a big deal in a 1-on-1 encounter. That sucks, because now as the Lucio player, you're going to struggle in a lot of environments, one-on-one, where you would have been fine otherwise. And upping the cost of his ult by 25%, I mean, that ult is game deciding when it's used either way. Its cost or how often it's available is kind of like, I don't really care. I think this is going to be kind of a net zero change, because you're not getting more than a couple of them off during the course of the game, because you're probably swapping away from Lucio at some point anyways. No one's just, oh, I'm just going to sit on Lucio all game. Like, that's not generally happening. So, I don't know. I thought the health fix was super elegant. I thought it introduced counterplay without making any of the characters feel a lot weaker. And I liked that a lot better than I like this, because now Lucio survives better, which is maybe intentional because he's supposed to be a support character, but he doesn't get to actually have the same bottom line impact on the state of the game, because he's got to be played more actively as a support and has less ability to sort of get up in the thick of it.
So I still think, like, the thing, I played a lot of Lucio. Lucio is the hero I have played the most of in Overwatch. And so I'm not the authority or anything, but there are a few things. Number one, I felt like his damage was just straight up sick with how much damage he could do with his little pulse ray gun thing that he does. Like, absolutely incredible, especially against still characters and turrets. And because they're so close, you can kind of, you know, just kind of pep, 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 and kind of pepper them kind of in a horizontal line. And you do great splash damage, especially for maps like Numbani and Lijiang Tower, where you've got the whole other team kind of on a place and you're supporting your team. You get to sit back and just kind of pep, 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 and, you know, just take down their health, you know, 25, 30 health at a time. And that was really effective. And you could do a lot of damage as a Lucio doing that. I didn't think that adjusting his health changed anything meaningful, except now that Lucio is basically a glass cannon. You can't go up and heal your teammates because you just get focused right away. They kill you and then done. And so now you had to play back and your team had to play more reserved. And I didn't like it. I always thought his health was good, but I don't think that it really addresses his issue. And the issue is the way he can self-heal as well as heal his team is probably too much, or the other supports are not enough. Between his passive heal and then basically any character, you've got your E up every 8 to 10 seconds. Every time a character gets close to killed, you pop that E and you and him go straight back up to almost full in 2 to 3 seconds. And another 5 to 7 seconds, you've got that up again on top of your ultimate, on top of great escapability. I feel like these are good changes, but I think that they're going to have to either make his E like not work on himself maybe, or something like that, because there's, I think he does way too much healing. He needs to have that high survivability because he's one of the only supports, thinking about it, maybe the only support who can actually be involved in a team fight, not kind of sitting back and supporting. And so I personally think it was the right changes to bring him toward balance, but he's still not there. Disagree. And that, you're nodding. You disagree so hard. Tell me about it.
No, I mean, okay. We're coming from different places. The way I see it is, you can't evaluate his balance in a vacuum because both teams have access to him, right? So his how good he is or isn't is only useful by comparison to how well he does against the other heroes. I never felt as a Lucio player like I was invulnerable. I never felt like I could just run in and take a fight one-on-one against anybody or be right up in melee range alongside my Reinhardt and not be at risk, right? I think there was always a risk and reward ratio there that was appropriate. And basically, what you had to do to kill a Lucio was the same thing you had to do to kill any player in the game, assuming that Lucio is available to them, which is kill them, right? If you damage somebody down to 10% and they run away, of course they're going to get healed up. In competitive play right now, the standard team comp uses 2, sometimes 3 supports. Like, they want to keep people alive because the time where the game gets decided is while someone is dead, right? If both teams have 6 players up, nothing's happening. When somebody dies, that's when, you know, it's all, in hockey terms, it's power plays and penalty kills, right? You want to be the team that has the extra man on the ice. That's what's happening. And I think Lucio is a super important part of that arrangement, right? In terms of the calculation of like what's going to happen on either side, you need a character that has that influence. In some ways, I think the problem is that he's just the only character that can heal multiple targets at once effectively. And that is a problem of character design in the sense that there should probably be more than one support who can heal multiple targets simultaneously efficiently. That's a different problem, but like I liked him having some meaningful frontline threat capability. I liked the fact that he, when he got up that close, put himself at risk with the lower health pool. I'll play him this way. I actually like him better with the higher health pool because I can be more aggressive at the cost of doing less damage. That's unfortunate, but like, I don't know. I felt like when he was at lower health, I had to play smarter, and now I can be a little ballsier and take more risks because I've got that extra bit of a cushion.
I think something too, though, you kind of hit on a point where it's like, well, he's the only one who really AOE kind of heals people, you know, which is true for supports. Every other one of the supports can only heal one at a time if they have a heal at all. But I think it's kind of the same thing with offense of like, oh, well, you know, not everybody can AOE do damage like Pharah, where things explode. And so don't make her things explode to hurt more than one target at one time. Like, I think that's okay to have. I think AOE healing is a good thing to have, just like having an AOE damage dealer, like having Junkrat just launch grenades on a control point blindly. You're not going to win one-on-one fights very often as a Junkrat unless you nail one of your grenades. But for the most part, you kind of sit back and you're there to support the team. And yeah, some of your great placed grenades, you know, do some serious damage and you get a lot of kills. But if someone comes up from behind or someone does something differently, like, you're going to get punished for that. And I think Lucio is the only support, and I think by design, who can be on the front lines. Mercy has a little bit of that because of her escape mechanism where she can just, you know, shift back to somebody, you know, like a sniper hanging out or whatever. But for the most part, I really think that Lucio needs to be the one who can be up front. And I like the slow AOE heal. I think his E is just too powerful. I think that's what it comes down to. I think his E is too powerful. So let's move on from here.
We're moving on. Okay.
A little bit. So May got some buffs. Her alt fire projectile speed increased by 50%, fire rate increased by 25%, and ammunition cost reduced from 40 to 25. Basically, they felt that while she is really there to help your team control the game, there was some room for her to be more powerful and be more threatening. And so they're going to try her doing that. And so I'm really excited with these changes. I really want to hop in and play Mei because I've always felt that offensively, it felt a little bit like if you didn't have a team that was working together and talking to each other, she would get punished for things that were out of your control, which basically discouraged, don't play Mei if you are solo queuing because you have no idea how good your team is going to be. And that didn't feel very good. Do you like these
changes?
Yeah,
I mean, I think for sure. I mean, she always, to me, felt like a character who her bottom line impact on the game had a lot to do with her non-damage skills, right? It had a lot to do with how you took advantage of her utility. Giving her a faster moving projectile, giving her a little bit of a higher fire rate, decreasing ammunition cost. It's not like she suddenly does more damage. It's not like she suddenly kills people way more efficiently. Like a 25% fire rate increase does not correlate to a 25% DPS increase because you've got to multiply that against accuracy, right? So, I mean, in general, I think this is a pretty safe set of buffs that makes her feel like you can contribute, you can have an effect on a fight, you can maybe do a little bit better as a duelist in a, like, oh, I'm stuck in a hallway against another person scenario. But ultimately, you're not picking Mei if you're trying to deal damage. So these are quality of life improvements, and I'm happy with them.
I think something that we're seeing, though, with each one of these changes is that it seems to be that more and more Blizzard is saying every hero needs to be able to deal some level of meaningful damage. And there's very few people who they've excluded from that. Like Mercy, like we're not seeing any buffs to Mercy's pistol. I would say to a point, D.Va out of her mech is again, but that makes sense. And so the more that we're seeing this, it detracts, I think, a little bit from the team play aspect of it, because now if you've got a Mei who's got great survivability, a great CC, and now meaningful damage, like that's a huge deal. Those are the type of people that you want on your team. A Reinhardt, a Mei, a Zarya, these people who can do meaningful damage, but bring something meaningful to the team as a whole. And there are some characters who aren't doing that, like Junkrat, you could argue, or Roadhog, where they don't really provide a whole lot to the team outside of them just being themselves. And so I wonder if we're going to either see Blizzard take a step back and, you know, take off the gas pedal a little bit and start to make them feel a little bit more different, or if we're going to see more and more of these damage increases to these secondary characters, not secondary, but like defensive support characters as we go further.
It's tough, right? Like, I think what you want in terms of, like, from a game design perspective, what you want is you want every character to feel like if they are stuck in a one-on-one engagement scenario, they have a chance. And there were times earlier in the beta where if you were placed in a one-on-one scenario with a particular character, you might just feel like there was nothing you could do. Like, the outcome was predetermined. If you put, you know, a Reaper and a Mei in a small hallway, Reaper wins. And at some point, that's probably healthy for the game. But in general, I feel like Blizzard's trying really hard to make it feel like that's not the case, and that you as a player always get to make a contribution. You see this with how they design stuff in every game, right? In World of Warcraft, they make it so that the tank classes deal, you know, conservatively, maybe like 70% of the amount of damage that a pure DPS class does, so that they still feel like they make a difference over the course of a long fight. They make it so that the healers in Heroes of the Storm, yeah, they heal, but they also can clear a wave of creeps or whatever and still get to have an impact on the game when there isn't a major team fight going on. And I think Overwatch philosophically shares a lot of those things. They want you to feel like yeah, if you run in and you're playing as a Lucio and you can't just like hang out with your team, you're playing as a Mei and there's no big combo to set up using your utility abilities, that you're still able to make a contribution or engage in a duel or otherwise do something that moves the needle a little bit in terms of what the game is going to look like. If your contribution is strictly utility, that sucks because you basically wait around until all the other players in your team are ready to take one fight, and that one fight determines the outcome of the game. And in Overwatch especially, that would be really, really awful. As is, it's bad enough when your teammates are running in and dying one-on-one and can't do anything and they can't make a difference. You need characters to have the ability to run in and just me by myself, even if my whole team isn't there, do something that disrupts the enemy team just long enough to hopefully swing the game for 5 seconds, because that's what's going to make the game feel like you can get the edge back and play from behind.
I completely agree, which is why we're going to talk about Zenyatta coming up last. Zenyatta's orbs no longer stack with each other and Transcendence costs 25% more. I think these both make total sense. The rationale was, you know, with multiple orbs of harmony, you basically a player could become invulnerable. And even for like a lot, multiple characters trying to kill a hero, they wouldn't be able to. So there was some ways to kind of cheese it. They called it degenerate playing or degenerate behavior or whatever they said. They said the word degenerate when they were describing the orb stacking motif. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And Transcendence, huge ult, happens often. A good Zenyatta basically makes it anytime you try to make a push on something, Zenyatta pops that up and all of a sudden you can't kill anyone on the team and it's kind of annoying. So I think those make sense. Anything else to add to those, Kev?
No, if anything, I'm surprised orbs stacked in the first place, frankly.
I was too. We were talking about it on Monday. We're like, do orbs even stack? And we're going to try it. But we ended up not trying it. So
problem solved on our behalf. Thank you, Blizzard. You saved us a few hours of testing.
Right. Yeah, it would take a few hours to try that, for sure. So last but not least, legendary skins. We've got some new ones, and these ones are awesome. We've got Steambot Bastion. It's like a steampunk version of Bastion. It looks amazing. Space Frog Lucio, hands down, my favorite skin by far. Kevin, so we were talking about this, actually. We were talking about, I love Lucio, but his skins suck because they're just like camo versions of what he's wearing and different colors. And it's like, well, that kind of stinks. So I think this is maybe the coolest skin that they've done. At least it's different, and it's the first one that I can think of that fundamentally changed the shape of the character. Am I right in that? Pretty close. Well,
the challenge in this game, right, is that they don't want skins to change the overall structure of a character, right? Like visually, the outline of the character should be basically the same. At a glance, you should be able to tell who it is. So they don't want characters to be noticeably different when they reskin them in terms of size, shape, general design. They're more like recolors than reskins, right? In comparison to how skin, that term gets used in other games. So you're right. It's tough. Like Lucio especially is a tough character to make look noticeably different without actually changing the character. And the Space Frog skin is legitimately the first one where I'm like, okay, yeah, I could see myself using that because it's not just Lucio wears different colors of pants.
Right. Yeah. So bravo, Blizzard. I really, really like the way you handled Space Frog Lucio. We've also got Mystery Man McCree, Raptorian Pharah, Lionheart Reinhardt. Amazing. Another amazing skin.
So good.
Just freaking epic. I hope we get to see. I hope they do like digital shorts with different skins. And I hope like Reinhardt has a bunch of these awesome different suits. And I hope he wears this one. Maybe it's like his formal wear. He wears it to like weddings and parties and things like that. And then we've got the spirit, Evil Knievel, spirit of 76, soldier 76. Again, another great think outside of the box type of skin that I absolutely love. If Blizzard keeps introducing skins like this, I'm going to lose a lot of money to this game. A lot. of money to this game.
You're not supposed to tell them that yet.
Yeah, that's true. You're right. I mean, I don't want to pay for skins at all. Blizzard, I think everyone should have
just put them.
Them
all in for free. Yeah.
I'm already paying $60 for the game. Why should I have to pay more for other content that doesn't affect the game
look
at
this,
all?
Look at this casual not buying a collector's edition. Payload fans, I apologize. We're all buying the collector's edition. Don't listen to him.
Yeah, that's true. All right, don't listen to me. All right. We got one more thing to wrap up here, then we're out of here, Kev. Kev, guess what? We got an email. We got an email.
We actually got an email.
We actually got a legit email, and we're going to talk about it on the show a little bit. It says, "Sup, Overwatch OGs." Must be talking to us. All right.
If you
had to pick the top two best heroes from each role, which one would you pick and why? And bonus question, if Blizzard lets you create your own hero, what would the kit look like and what would the hero look like? So I'm going to give you the second part as homework. We're going to talk about it next week on the show. But the first part, top two heroes in each category and why. Let's start with offense. Before you give me the why, give me the two that you have to pick. I'm putting you on the spot. Top two offense.
On the spot, top two offense, I would probably say, and it's just personal, I would probably say Tracer and McCree.
Cool. I would say Tracer and Pharah. So Tracer, I think, for me personally, great mobility, can get out of virtually every situation. Her ultimate is great for, you know, getting people away from a specific spot or killing a tank, one-shotting a tank. You just run up, boom, put it, run away. Does really decent damage if you hit all your shots. And so I think it's a no-brainer. Why'd you pick Tracer?
100% it's a mobility thing. We talked about offense last week on the show, and you can go back and listen to the offense episode if you want to get the like full kind of chit-chat about it. But in general, I heavily value mobility, and I think Tracer right now is one of the characters whose toolkit specifically counters a lot of the like stationary static defense style of play, because you can get in behind somebody, you can do a lot of work, and there's very little else you can do to break a heavily fortified position if you can't get in and disrupt it, which is Tracer's specialty.
Right. And then I would have picked Genji before the nerf to his health. But I think Pharah is just really good, really versatile, especially for control maps, because that those things do such great splash damage that she can just sit out there and lob those in kind of like a junk rat. But you chose McCree, which I thought was interesting, because I felt like last week when we talked about McCree, you weren't so hot on him. So tell me why.
Well, so here's the thing, okay? I love Pharah. I play way more Pharah than I play McCree because I like the mobility. I like being able to sort of take those angles, abuse verticality. But in terms of raw damage throughput, I feel like McCree has a way bigger swing potential on the game, both because he's got higher damage and a lower long distance damage drop off than a lot of the other characters on offense, but also because he's got an ult that has so, like, we talked a little bit about his ult and how everybody has to frantically try to counter it because it has so much swing potential. If a good McCree ult goes off and knocks out two or three people, that changes the state of the game instantly and irreversibly. There's nothing you can do to respond to it. So I think, despite the fact that I don't like him as much personally, because I prefer characters that can get around the map better, he's so good, and he's good in a way that doesn't require the same up close and personal touch that a lot of the other offense characters do. You don't need to get as close as a Tracer or a Genji or a Reaper. You can do your job from a way further distance away and delete people in way less shots than something like, say, a Soldier 76, where you actually have to do a lot of damage over time. Like McCree, couple of good shots and somebody dies. True. So that's
he's versatile.
I picked McCree because I lose to him.
Right.
I picked McCree because he kills me.
A good McCree. So you pick a good McCree.
Absolutely.
If you're bad at McCree, he sucks. He sucks so bad.
If you're mediocre, please don't play McCree.
At least on my team. If you're on the opponent's team, if you're bad at the game, McCree's a great person to start out with. And yeah, I don't know. Okay. So next, defense. Quick. Defense, Kev. Who do you pick?
I mean, my first choice has always been Widowmaker, just because she's such a core part of the defense game and counters so many things very specifically. Second choice defense, I probably right now would say Bastion.
Cool. I would say Bastion and Junkrat. So, all right.
Sure.
50%. I think we can both easily. So Bastion, I think, just makes sense.
Well, especially after the changes, like before the changes, he was really good, but way too limited. Now he feels like he's got a way more versatile toolkit. I actually like him way better post changes.
I do. It's the people who just would sit up in a corner and, you know, pep away, you know, aren't very happy with Bastion right now because, well, he still does a lot of damage, but he's pretty easy to counter if you just stay in the same place all game. But if you run it back and forth between Sentry and Recon, I was watching Seagull play and he would set down, get a couple kills. Once he knew that the opponent's team was onto him and was going to go look for them over there, he'd go into Sentry mode and like sneak around. It was like this game of cat and mouse. Absolutely brilliant. And I think that that's the way I've seen Bastion play best. And I love that type of play style. And I think that's the type of play style that Blizzard is trying to encourage. When you need to hold down a choke point, yeah, he sets up in Sentry mode and just focuses on that. But then if the payload's moving, you're doing that. And it also, in past, when he was just in Sentry mode and you would just sit there, he was only good on defense and he was only good on control and point capture maps. He wasn't good on payload maps or honestly most control maps. Only certain situations with open spaces was he actually, you know, really any good. So totally agree with that. For me, Junkrat, I just think the splash damage that it does, again, I think it's something where I'm just really in love with splash damage in this game, because we're seeing less Lucio making more damage on more heroes really puts stress on Pharah and Zenyatta, and you can trust your offensive players to finish that off. I think he's got a strong ultimate, and so that's why I would pick Junkrat there. I know you've already talked about your crush on Widowmaker a little bit, but to kind of summarize it all into why you think she's one of the best defensive players, go ahead.
It's 100% for me about how counterplay works, right? There's a lot of characters in the game who are heavily reliant on their ability to recover from damage. We just finished having this big conversation about things like Lucio being able to knock a character down a majority or all of their health, or abuse the stationary characters when they're trying to stop and line up, whether it's a McCree ult or a stationary Bastion or whatever else. Like, there's a lot of stuff in the game where being still is very, very dangerous, and you survive it by being able to take a couple of hits and then move, or a couple of hits and then recover. And the only thing in the game, in my mind, that really punishes that in a severe way is being sniped. And Widowmaker's the only character. Nobody does more damage in a single hit than Widowmaker outside of alts. So it's a huge part.
I don't know what Hanzo's snipes do. Either way,
I don't think they do more than a Widowmaker headshot. So I think it's a high amount, but it's a very different character. So
right.
I for sure see Widowmaker as having one of the biggest potentials for counterplay in the game. She's the kind of character where you want to pull her out, kill the couple of people you need to kill, and then quickly switch away from her. But she's got a huge impact on the state of the game.
Sure. Totally agree. So tanks, I'm going to go with Reinhardt for sure. Ugh, hard between Zarya and Winston, but I think right now with his shields, I'm going to go Winston. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I really wanted it to be Zarya, but I mean, Reinhardt's been number one ever since the game came out, still is. If anything, I'm kind of thinking they might have to do something there eventually to tweak him so that he's not such an obvious first choice. And Winston right now, whether it's his shield or the ability to get in and disrupt a target or get onto a capture point really fast and stay on it while you're in overtime, whatever it is, like, I want it to be Zarya. I want it to be Zarya really badly, yeah. But for sure it's Winston. Just the mobility. Mobility is way too important.
Yeah, I think Zarya is the healthiest tank right now as far as the combination of being, you know, tanky and contributing to your team, whereas Winston and Reinhardt are much more traditional tanks, but they're much better and much more effective, in my opinion. And last,
yep, totally agree.
And last, supports. I'm gonna say Lucio.
Is it not Lucio and Mercy?
Honestly, so it's tough because I love Zenyatta. I think Lucio has to be in there, but Zenyatta, I'm stuck between Zenyatta and Symmetra. Honestly, I don't think I would pick Mercy.
What?
I think I would put Mercy as last. We're just going to sit here in silence.
We're just going to stare at each other. I'm so startled. I feel like I've seen a ghost.
Tell me.
All right.
Tell
so
me why.
Lucio. No. Okay. We agree on Lucio. Lucio has the most versatility, the most flexibility of any support right now, and is such a core part of the game. It's hard to imagine not having him. Agreed?
Agreed.
All right. So that's done. Mercy for me, again, it's about swing potential. There's very little in the game that swings the state of the game as fast or as effectively as her ult. And she's also the only thing in the game right now that affects damage in a positive fashion in a meaningful sense with her boost beam. It's way more significant than anything else in the game in terms of modifying damage. I mean, and they had to tweak it, obviously, but like, I don't know if I had to pick, if I was going to run in and play not as the support player and have two supports backing me, they're the two I would want. Like 10 times out of 10. Zenyatta's very powerful, has some cool kit stuff going on, but doesn't do the same amount of work in a team fight environment. And Symmetra, I mean, Symmetra's, again, like one of those characters that's super good as a duelist, offers a lot of utility, but I think of her as a defense character. I very rarely even think of her as a support because she doesn't actually heal. She offers so little in the way of support characters. Well, but really, I mean, if this game had like a category for specialists, the way that Heroes of the Storm does, that's where I'd drop her.
I mean, I would agree with that her inclusion into support may be there, but there's a few undeniable facts. Number one, teams win the most with Symmetra. Number one, Teleporter is huge. It's very huge for the team. She can do really decent damage. Those turrets, a Symmetra with well-placed turrets can be completely invaluable. It can totally shut down parts of the map that you don't want the other team going to. The reason why I don't pick Mercy, it goes back to the thing is, I think right now, if you're not playing a character that can contribute on offense, the other team is, and you're behind. It's your, you called it something earlier, power play and penalty kills. And it's kind of like, okay, we're on the power play, but for our extra man that we would have, our man advantage, we're going to put in a second goalie so that they don't get a shorthanded goal. It's kind of what it feels like. And so, yes, Mercy is very strong, but I think right now where the meta game is that really, really prioritizes every, you know, the support characters healing whoever needs the most health, or in Lucio's case, you know, AoE healing the important parts of the map where the fights are going on right now. Having a Zenyatta be able to sit back and pepper, basically you can target, you can focus. It's basically like putting up a focus target, right? When you see that Discord orb, you can coordinate a focus target. You can heal their team's focus target on your team, and you can do really devastating damage. Symmetra, something different, but provides that type of utility, blocks down parts of the map, and I just don't think Mercy does it, especially with the range being nerfed so hard on her ultimate. I don't see enough Mercies where people are dying enough to be able to launch off a meaningful ult. I'm not seeing her a whole lot in tournaments, but I haven't watched a whole lot of tournaments the last like week and a half. So,
I mean, I guess you're probably right if you were to evaluate playability as a whole. I was thinking very specifically in terms of how well they fulfill the job of that particular role. I would never, like, if your team is only going to get one support, it's never going to be a Symmetra, it's never going to be a Zenyatta, in my opinion, right? It's going to be a Lucio or a Mercy.
Sure.
Yeah.
I would... Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Right. I mean, it's it just comes down to like the way the characters are categorized. I love Zenyatta's toolkit. I think he has one of the coolest kits in the game, but I can't really think about him as a support because he doesn't do that job as far as I'm concerned. That single orb healing one person doesn't actually solve the problem of I need to keep my teammates alive. His ultimate's phenomenal, but like I think of it as like, okay, once my team has a Lucio or a Mercy, then I'll go grab a Zenyatta or a Symmetra, but they don't actually do that role job as efficiently. They're always second string once you've got a primary healer.
I agree, but I think Lucio does that so well.
Yeah, I mean, Lucio is the obvious pick for it right now, which is kind of, you know, there's pros and cons to that, but...
All right. So, last thing that I'll say, final closing argument. You ready?
Sure, hit me.
Closing argument, I would pick, I think as is, right now with what I'm seeing, I would pick a Zenyatta over a Mercy. And if I was with a team of six, I would pick a Mercy over a Zenyatta. So that's my closing statement. And I think we need to get out of here. We talked way longer than I thought I would. Do you have a closing thought?
Counter argument, closing argument, new voice actor on Mercy.
That's true. You're right. Huge buff.
That's all
huge
I got.
Huge buff. All right. Well, thank you guys so much for hanging out with us for episode number 15. We had a blast. Thank you for your emails. Again, that was a really good question. We'll get to the second half next week. Kevin, I did not think that we would talk about Overwatch this much. For being just the two of us and being a show in 3 days, but we just jabberjawed on. It's always a pleasure,
you know, it's crazy. Oh, obviously, but it's crazy how much is going on. Like this game now, we know is going to be out in 10 weeks or whatever. Like the countdown's on here, and I think at this point the changes are going to come fast and furious because Blizzard's got a lot of work to do to get this thing ready for release. So we're just going to have this much or more to talk about every week, it feels like, which is a little terrifying, but also awesome.
Right. So any shout outs, last things you want to pump up before we close out the show?
Not a ton, actually. I mean, it's crazy that it's been 15 episodes already. I can't even remember how long ago episode one was. It feels like it's just time flies. So I'm super stoked to still be doing this. Big ups, obviously, to all the people who are hanging out with us in chat live every week. If you want to join us, we do this thing every Thursday, 7 p.m. Pacific on twitch.tv/BlizzPro. Love to have you join us. Come hang out and chat with us. Maybe play some games when we're done the show for the night. And I'm going to miss a show coming up here right away because I'm actually going to be presenting at the iGaming North America conference in Las Vegas. So I'm going to miss that first show in April.
That's awesome. Congrats, man. That'll be great.
Thanks, dude.
As for me, pretty minimal. If you do check out Hearthstone type stuff, we've got Firebat on the show this week. So that's really exciting.
It's going to be so good.
I'm really excited to have that. Besides that, I've been streaming a lot too. So mainly if you are into watching Hearthstone or Overwatch, I'm streaming over at twitch.tv/kicktripod. You should come hang out. It's been a lot of fun. But yeah, I think that is going to about do it for episode number 15. You can find more Overwatch stuff throughout the week at overwatch.blizzbro.com. A big thanks to Jake at Jake Buttineau, BUTINEAU.CA. Check out his stuff. He does awesome work. He's done all of our audio work for WellMet and the payload, and I think everything that I'll probably ever do for podcasting for the rest of my life. ScytheDesigns.com. Dread Scythe does an awesome job. We look great, and it's because of that guy. Tweet us at Payload Podcast. Send us your emails to thepayload@blizzpro.com. Send us your iTunes reviews. We greatly appreciate them. It helps us appear higher in the rankings. If we're doing a good job, we want to know about it. If not, send us an email. If you've got some ideas to make the show better, send us an email. The payload at blizzbro.com. I'm going to send them the wrong. Send your constructive criticisms to thegarbage@hearthstone.com. Just kidding. Last but not least, yeah, you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Podcast Addict, and all your other favorite podcast outlets. This has been episode number 15, and we will see you next week. Oh my gosh, totally hit the wrong button. This is great. Boom, wrong one again. And there we go.
The Payload is a production of BlizzPro. Find out more about Overwatch at overwatch.blizzpro.com. You can find your host throughout the week on social media. Find Jimmy on Twitter at DJ Tyrant, Kevin on Twitter at Lack of Realism, and John on Twitter at Kicked Tripod.
That was amazing. That was the best thing ever.